Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United Archive.
Really exciting to talk to Matthew Broderick. I've been wanting to talk to him for a long time. You know and love him, of course, from films like War Games and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Lady Hawk, Biloxi Blues, Glory, Election, and the Broadway and cinematic incarnations of The Producers. But in recent years, Matthew's cultivated an assortment of some of the most interesting characters of his career in a series of daring independent films. I'm thinking of your father. He was an amazing actor, and you've worked with so many greats in your career, Brando and Hoffman and Connery and on and on and on.
Yeah.
Is there a single lesson or observation that has, when you've been working with these people or from your father, that you found most useful or meaningful to you in your career?
I don't know if there's a single one. I remember my father once, when I auditioned for something and didn't get a part, and I was really disappointed, and he said, "You always think you didn't get it because you would say, I blew it or something." And he said, "How do you know they didn't blow it? Because they don't know any more than you, and they choose the wrong person all the time."
Yeah.
So that was kind of a relief to me, you know, that the people on the other side of the desk don't know any more than you know.
Right.
That was good for starting out. And then, I don't know about acting. You learn from watching people. The one thing in common with all those people you mentioned is they all, no matter what they say, they work really hard.
Right.
You know, they might all say, "This is bullshit, who cares?" But they all really try, and they all get really mad when things don't go well and really happy when they go well. Like, they all care about it.
And when you're talking about the satisfaction that you get from performing, has that changed or matured over the years for you since when you first started?
Yes, I think to some degree. I think when I was starting out, I could sort of think of it like a hobby, which was nice. You know, I thought, I'll do this for a while, and if it doesn't work out, I'll do something else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, but as you get older, you have to be careful of a creeping desperation, you know, to kind of, I know I can't suddenly do something else for a living now, probably, so
right.
I feel slightly more, but it also changes year by year. Like, I just did a play that I had a really great time in, and I felt like I knew what I was doing, and I felt like I was a good actor, and so I feel very revived. But for about a year before that, I felt like I'm just basically getting worse every year, and this stinks. And I think that's my age.
The Sunday evening, the top of the show, our archive clip for tonight's show was Matthew Broderick from about 3 or so years ago. And I always ask that of actors that have been doing it for a long time, that same question about what does it mean to you now that's different from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his was my favorite answer, because that was pretty honest to say that there was a period of time where he thought he was getting worse as an actor. I always admired and appreciated that answer.
Right, no, it's probably one of the best answers, and just coming from him, it means a lot, so, yeah.
Yeah, because if you think, like most people in the creative arts, I mean, they're plagued with self-doubt.
Oh, yeah.
To begin with, so yeah. Great show for you tonight, Virginia Madsen, one of our finest actresses, is on the show tonight to talk about a new film that she has, directed by Rob Reiner, co-starring Morgan Freeman, called The Magic of Belle Isle. It's
available
now.
It's on demand, actually, yeah.
Yeah, on demand, and it'll be in selected theaters first week of July. Did you? What came out this weekend? Was it? Oh, it was the Disney thing, the Pixar thing.
No, the Pixar thing's good. I like how you said Disney thing first, though. That's a really interesting slip, because it may be the most Disney of all the Pixar movies. And I mean it kind of not as bad as it sounds, because, I mean, it reminded me at parts of, like, of the movie Tangled at times,
mm-hmm.
if that
mm-hmm.
makes sense to you,
mm-hmm.
if you can understand that. But also, the other movie it reminded me, not a Disney film, but was the one that came out a couple of years ago, How to Train Your Dragon, to an extent. It reminded me of that. But it's actually a very good movie, and far superior to Cars 2, which was the last Pixar thing.
It's good news.
It's actually a very well-done movie. Don't get me wrong. I can see where Keith had problems with it, though. I can definitely see where anyone would have problems with this.
You know, I looked up his review.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read his review?
Parts of it, not the whole thing. I won't lie to you.
Yeah.
I just looked at when before he came on the show. Yeah.
It was interesting. I think it was mostly he used a particular word. That's an adult word, and
mm-hmm.
I think people took offense to such an adult word being included in a review of a children's movie.
Right. No,
More so than his opinion on the movie, because honestly, a lot of people are lukewarm on the movie.
I can understand it, and I am watching it. Let me be very honest with you. Watching halfway through the film, I could see that. I could totally. I think that's a very valid. They're very valid criticisms of the film. It's that the film picks. It's where the film goes with that, though. The film could have easily gone another way, and it would have been, you know, yeah. But I think the middle of the film is a mess.
But I heard that it portrays the female heroine and her relationship with her mother in a way that's unlike anything else in these types of movies.
That's true. That's very true. But not doing any sort of research before going to see this film, not knowing a goddamn thing what it's about except for the trailer, I'm like, really? This is what we're dealing with? Oh, my God. Okay.
You went in brave. Yeah.
You know, but it actually is, like I said, I like how they deal with it and everything, but I could totally see where the lukewarm and negative reviews are coming from. I could totally, because I was thinking about that while watching it, and I was like, I can definitely, okay, this may not be one of the better efforts, but it does, in the third act, really everything comes together.
Well, it was a kid's weekend, because Brave came in first place and Madagascar 3 held on for second place. And then there's Abraham Lincoln in third place, Vampire Hunter.
There's a better movie than that, though, that I saw, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Oh, yeah?
I liked it. I know a lot of, if no one, did anyone else even go see it? But I liked it. It's hard, it's like, my mom kept saying it's really hard to get worked up about the movie, about the end of the world, because it's not melancholy, and that was so good, and she liked it, but I liked it. There's a lot of things going on in the movie, but it is hard. How should I say it? Since you know the outcome of the movie, I guess it's hard to get worked up about it and hard to get interested in it since it is what the movie says it is. I mean, there's no surprises or anything.
Yeah, but it's like a romantic comedy, new lease on life right before the world ends.
Yeah. It reminded me of Night of the Comet of all movies. That's what I kept thinking of.
Well, that's always good.
No, that was. That's what I kept thinking of. And
we had her on, you know, the director of that, the Lorraine Scafaria. This is the first movie she's directed. We had her on because she wrote Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
That was a good
movie.
I remember that. That was a good movie. It's actually a well-done movie. I have no beef with it whatsoever.
I read our friend Tony's views on it, and he actually said he thought it was okay. He's just sick of Steve Carell playing the sad sack divorced guy, or the wife dies or leaves him, and, you know, he's trying to get back, or, you know.
But he does it so well that I... He does it so well that I really
he's found his niche.
But he's found that. But, you know, he is considered to be leading man material. I mean, he is really, and I think in some of these films he's come into his own.
He's a very appealing actor. He really is.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. There's a scene with him and Rob Corddry's in the movie, and I turn to my mom and I'm going, you realize that Jon Stewart basically gave these guys their big break? I mean, you know, The Daily Show has created this whole cottage industry of actors. But it's not a bad, it's a very interesting movie. It is actually a very good movie. I don't know if you need to rush out to theaters. You can watch it when it comes on, you know, cable or whatever. But it's actually a very interesting movie, and they work off very well together, him and Keira Knightley, very well.
You know, did you read Alexander Payne's next movie is called Nebraska? It's
yes,
a road,
I know.
It's a
I know
road
it,
movie.
Yes.
Road movie, black and white. His two leads are Bruce Dern and Will Forte.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh my God.
I don't know. That must be a low budget movie, because when I think, like, people aren't going to be inclined to go see a black and white road relationship movie anyway.
With Bruce Dern.
And Bruce Dern and Will Forte. I mean, it's interesting.
Wow.
But there's a studio that has confidence in you as a director.
Yes.
You can convince them to finance that.
Mm-hmm. True. Very true.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we mentioned Abraham Lincoln comes in third place this weekend. Speaking of Lincoln, I mean, Spielberg, I think he's probably done shooting his movie about Lincoln, with Daniel Day-Lewis portraying Lincoln.
Right.
Tommy Lee Jones was overseas. He was doing press for the international junkets for Men in Black 3, and they asked him about Lincoln, and he said, look, Daniel Day-Lewis is the best we've ever seen. I mean, this is... I'll actually bring up the quote, but it's interesting because this website where I found this quote, /film, all the comments on here, people arguing back and forth about Lincoln, about the President Lincoln, what he did, what he didn't do, what party he would belong to today. But I mean, a lot of venom about Abraham Lincoln.
That's disturbing within itself. But I also read, I don't know who would have, but have there been enough cinematic portrayals of Lincoln? I mean, there's obviously Henry Fonda, the young Mr. Lincoln, which is a very good portrayal. And there have been, like, things like TV movie, The Lincoln Conspiracy, and let me be, like, even Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, the portrayal of Lincoln. But has there really been a serious biopic Lincoln?
Portrayal in all media. I mean, whether it be Honest Abe or whatever, we're predisposed to think of Lincoln. Tommy Lee Jones says, I don't think President Lincoln has ever been portrayed as well. Daniel Day-Lewis has read his history, has read his books, and his Lincoln is a country boy who also happens to be a brilliant lawyer and poet. This isn't a Lincoln that just stepped off the dollar bill or just arisen from the Lincoln Monument. This is not the icon or the hero, and he's not the joke of the old Honest Abe nonsense. This is a real man. And this is interesting because Tommy Lee Jones plays a character, Thaddeus Stevens.
Right, okay.
He was the head of the Ways and Means Committee in the 50s. So, it's interesting.
Well, it's going to... Look, I think Spielberg doing a movie about Lincoln is fascinating within itself. I think based on the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Team of Rivals, is brilliant. It's going to be very interesting because the release date is, God, how do I say this? There's two movies coming out at the end of this year, the Bin Laden movie and this movie, that are big election time movies.
Right.
Let's be very honest here. It would be really ironic if the current president isn't reelected, because Team Arrivals was something that everyone was recommended to read for his administration, especially since he picked Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State and everything. So this is a president who, when he was elected, was thought of, regardless now where we are now, but when he was elected, was thought of this way. And I can't wait to see it. I'm very curious. I mean,
Before he did anything, he was thought of this way.
And that's ridiculous. And I think everyone's a little guilty of that who voted for him, obviously. I know I am. I'm certainly, and I need to purge myself of those thoughts totally. But this is going to be a fascinating movie. Fascinating.
Yeah.
What is it Dennis Hopper says in True Romance? History, I find that shit fascinating.
Yeah. It'll be good. It's been a long time coming, so it'll be good. I hope it's more private Ryan than Amistad.
Well, okay. That said, I don't think. How do I say this? There's been a thing going around as an undercurrent, especially after last year, that Spielberg has lost his groove.
Right.
I don't really necessarily believe that. I really don't believe that.
I don't think so either. I mean, if you see something, I just think he's been making movies I don't like. Because if you see something like 1010,
yeah,
which I don't like, I mean, Spielberg is there. He's working it.
Mm-hmm.
And his visual prowess is as strong as it's ever been.
Right.
I just don't like the material. I just don't like the movie. I don't think it does anything.
Right.
You know?
I agree with you on that. But I think it's still there. I think he still shows some magic with War Horse. I even think even in Crystal Skull, as mediocre as it is, there's still some flashes there of Spielberg.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think Crystal Skull's failure was a fault of direction in terms of camera actors, that
right.
kind of thing. I think it was a fault of direction in terms of script.
Right. I agree with that, totally.
Let's bring on Dean. Hey, Dean.
Hey, what's up?
What's up?
They're talking
hey.
Spielberg again, huh?
Yeah, I'll get off that real quick. I'm looking forward to the movie with Angela Bassett and how Spielberg got his groove back. It'll be good.
Yeah.
I was interested because we're doing our show on Wednesday night, Movies That Need Sequels.
Yes.
I mean, and you know, I have a problem with that word need, but I couldn't figure out any other way to express it in a short, succinct title because we don't need anything. But movies that that we'd like to see sequels to, I mean, that's a little
yeah.
informal for a title for a show, but that's essentially what we're talking about. And I was thinking of a movie that... there couldn't be a sequel, but it's one of the most fascinating character studies for me from the 70s, which was Dog Day Afternoon.
Right.
So I thought, who? So I looked up the real guy. I hadn't looked him up before. Like, whatever became of that real guy that Pacino plays, the bank robber Sonny?
Sonny Wojcik, right?
But yeah, based on a true story. Do you guys know what happened to him?
No, I don't. What?
I have no idea.
He actually... he liked the movie a lot. Like in 75, he wrote a letter to the New York Times, I think it was, and he bragged about a lot of the stuff in the film, like Pacino's great, the direction's great, Cazale is wonderful, blah, blah, blah. But he vehemently opposed the idea that he in any way sold out Sal.
Yeah, I did know about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, he was really up in arms about that. And also he objected to the fact that they showed it in prison where he was. And several attempts were made on his life following that screening in prison.
And involving that particular aspect of the movie, like he was
yeah.
a rat?
No, involving probably that he paid for his lover's sex change operation. I would think.
I would think that in prison, that would be okay, because,
Yeah, because that goes over well in prison. But the... But he got out. He lived on welfare in Brooklyn. He died in 2006 of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The girl, whose name is, I think, Elizabeth, she died in 87 of AIDS. And I read his story, and, I thought this was one of the great characters of the 1970s cinema. So it was interesting to finally realize what became of the real counterparts. But I thought it was so weird that, imagine, Jerry, that someone portrays your life on screen and the movie is brilliant and becomes an all-time classic and one of the defining performances ever.
Mm-hmm.
You carry that with you your entire life, and yet you've never met the actor that played you. I mean, Pacino never met Sonny.
Right, mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just
right.
weird, that you are somehow intricately related to someone that you've never met, that has
yeah.
made the entire world
know
aware
about
of your
you.
Story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and just walking around in your normal everyday life, you knowing who you are, but most
but
everybody
the world
else
sees you differently, though. I mean,
yeah. And you have to tell people, well, I'm the guy that, which was probably not something that he wanted to tell a lot of people. Yeah, well,
yeah.
Don't ask, it's based on me, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So,
hey, I found this on Facebook, like Bobby posted it, and I thought it was interesting. I guess they unearthed some tapes. You know, Coppola recorded a lot of stuff on the set of Apocalypse Now.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
And this is, I just thought this was kind of a delicious
soundbite.
Apparently Marlon Brando did not like Burt Reynolds. And we have the sound clip to prove it. I mean, this is just a point of curiosity, but I thought I'd play it for everyone out there.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Marlon Brando talking to Francis Coppola about Burt Reynolds.
Okay, but by the time you get the bells over it and all that stuff, who the fuck's going
to
know?
I don't think he thinks it's Burt Reynolds.
That's one of the reasons we're doing
Don't say that name around me.
You not like him?
He is the epitome of something that makes me want to throw up.
He's a nice guy.
He is?
You
want
to come in here?
No,
I don't know why I hate him.
So he is a nice guy, is everything.
He can't be. He's the epitome of everything that's disgusting about the thespian. Just holy.
Where did you get that idea? I don't know him at all.
He worships at the temple of his own narcissism.
Yeah. You want to try?
Totally narcissistic person.
Well, I don't want to meet him either.
Get in there. Let's get this thing going.
You know what really disgusted me? I saw him on the TV one time. It was at an opening of some movie he did called something about cat dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And he had ordered some Indian kids there because it was a little anti-Indian, and he wanted to make some compensations for it. So he ordered a little Indian kid there, brought in from someplace. So the kid was brought in. It was about a 3 or 4 year old kid, and he wanted to show how loving he was to the kid. So he stooped down and was playing for the cameras of, oh, how I love children, and that kind of thing. And the kid started to go away, to go off camera. So he pulled the kid back and was trying to make the kid make a little scene of how sweet Bert was and respected children. But it was such a shitty, the whole idea of it, hustling children so you could...
Did you ever know him?
Project, no, I don't know.
The great thing about kids, though, they can't be bullshit.
Yeah, the kid wouldn't play the bullshit. He wouldn't do the bullshit. Just wanted to go back to his mother.
Surreal. I mean, I heard that yesterday when you posted it.
I love hearing that voice, man. He's a monument to his own narcissism. Oh, it's great.
You know, Burt Reynolds would occasionally do a Marlon Brando imitation on like, you know, Tonight Show. I wonder if that ever had anything to do with it. You know, like maybe.
I don't know. I mean, everybody does one. I mean, if you're an actor, you in one way or another, you basically had an imitation of Brando in your pocket.
But when he says this, though, I mean, Burt Reynolds is at the top of his game.
Yeah, biggest movie star.
And he's obviously, there's some jealousy in there.
I think so.
I would have to say that because Marlon, you know, I'm like a broken record in this household, but I always bring up the fact that The Godfather is the greatest comeback performance of all time. I do think he's Brando's performance in The Godfather because he was considered, you know, washed up. Even though those movies in the 60s are considered box office poison, they are good performances. Let's not beat around the bush. There are some really great performances in there. But as far as studio, this Paramount was concerned, like, no, you can't put him in here. But I can see where, you know, Burt Reynolds in the 70s, I remember growing up, I mean, come on, Smokey and the Bandit, Hooper, The End, Gator, I mean, you had a whole list, Deliverance, obviously. But you had a whole host of movies. He was the biggest movie star, and I can definitely see there's a lot of jealousy.
Well, Marlon Brando became the biggest movie star, just not the same kind of biggest movie star.
Yeah.
That Burt Reynolds was.
Right.
Yeah. He literally became the biggest movie star. Like, literally.
Thank you.
how much further can I drive this joke, though? I just want to make sure you guys got the meaning. Okay. But it's, you know, Brando is a sea of, like, conflicting motivations and emotions, and because, I mean, on one hand, he looked and he detested the kind of the narcissism that ran rampant
mm-hmm.
in his profession. Another way, I'm sure, in some ways, that he himself was a victim of it.
Displayed the same sort of narcissism.
Yeah, I mean, I was
going to
say, I thought it was hypocritical.
The same sort of narcissism. Yeah.
I mean, to denounce the value or the worth of the same profession in which you completely redefined
mm-hmm.
single-handedly is something else. I mean, that's a complicated guy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Do you think? I mean, do you think that is Godfather your favorite Brando?
No, but I think it's his. I think it is a thing that, you know, which you. It's hard to look at that. Like, I just got done reading Ed Falco's The Family Corleone. It's
right.
hard to read that book without not seeing him.
Oh, it's iconic, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's who you think of. Hell, I, for me, if you want to know my favorite, Brando's On the Waterfront. If I have
yes.
to be very honest, On the Waterfront, I think, is just one of the greatest performances.
Yeah, I prefer, I like Streetcar Named Desire, personally. But.
Oh, and that's a good one, too. I mean, and The Man is awesome. And I even like Viva Zapata, I think, is good. There's a lot of great performances other than The Godfather, but I think it is The Godfather that I consider as though the thing that really brought him back into the fold, obviously, and redefined
yeah.
a lot of things.
We actually have one of our clips on YouTube, because
mm-hmm.
we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited. There are 364 videos that we posted up of interview and talk
mm-hmm.
segments. But we have one that you, me, and Chris did, Jerry,
mm-hmm.
talking about the legacy of Brando.
Right.
That's an interesting listen. But, I mean, my favorite is Last Tango. And that's actually kind of like his, I think that's the most naked and raw
right.
performance
mm-hmm.
he's ever given. And I also think that's his swan song, really, in terms of great, powerful, lasting performances. I think he put it all on the line, and that was the last time he did that in that movie.
And I think that's the last performance, too, where he didn't, like, go to the director and say, I demand the world in order, before I'll even act a
right.
second brief. You know,
yeah.
it's like, I think that was the very last time he ever
and
did
that.
And
that was right after Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it contains the most powerful scene in terms of acting that I've ever seen.
Right.
With him with his dead wife.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's like we were talking about this the other day, and we bring this up a lot. It's, you know, if James Dean had lived, there would be a lot more powerful Marlon Brando performances, because that was his competition.
Yeah.
And I think when James Dean is no longer in the picture, how shall I say it? There's a certain level of slack, if you will.
Yeah,
well,
there's
what?
A lot of wind that goes out of his sails at that
yeah.
point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what role does Montgomery Clift play?
Montgomery Clift is another one that you know, we don't talk about this movie a lot. I read the book and I've seen the movie countless times. The Young Lions. The Young Lions is a, how should I say it, is a cornucopia of just great acting from, you know, not great, but you have Clift and you have Brando in this movie, a World War II movie based on this book from that time. And, I mean, Clift is very important. Clift is another one that I, you know, that's good. It's very important that you bring that up. If Clift had lived, I think that would have had an impact on Brando's performances over the years.
Well, I think the thing that, you know, Clift was kind of dead before he was dead because he was drinking so much. So,
well, that,
I mean,
that will do it to you.
That was,
I mean, just look at Richard Burton. I mean, that will do it to you.
Yes. He was kind of. I mean, by the time Clift got to, I mean, of course, he had the accident. Which
the accident did him in.
The accident that changed his look, and
mm-hmm.
and that was a big deal, too. But even by that point, he was still acting. But, you know, by the time he got onto the set of something like Judgment at Nuremberg, you know, they really had to work, you know, Stanley Kramer had to work overtime to get
right.
him to to get any kind of lines out. And both he and Judy Garland both really had to coax that performance out of him. Of course, he ended up getting an Oscar nomination for that. But it was only one scene that he was in, but it was just he was eaten up by the drink and by the nervousness and everything. Mm-hmm. So it was really the drinking that really erased him from the running long time before he got out of the business. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about method acting as it relates to Hitchcock when we come back from our interview.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't see
a lot of method acting in Hitchcock, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point of the conversation after this interview.
Okay.
Virginia Madsen, she's a great actress, Academy Award nominated for Sideways, but she's been around so much longer before that. Great movies, including her latest one, which is called The Magic of Belle Isle. It stars Morgan Freeman. It's directed by Rob Reiner. It is a pure pleasure to watch. It's available on demand. I highly recommend everyone out there order it. But it's in limited release starting July 6th. And we had a few minutes with Virginia last week where she discussed the movie and the working conditions of the movie and the great people she's working with us. And here is Virginia.
What's he yelling at?
Life.
Might be a good place to write.
You want me to write?
Well, let's start.
Girls, it's not polite to stare.
I'm a big admirer of your work.
Sometimes I want to pull my pants down.
Join the club.
There's more to life than the way you're living it.
Stuff your ideas in the suggestion box on your way out.
I have to go into the city for the day. I was wondering if you might stay with the girl.
You want me to babysit?
Thank you, Miss Wells.
Who's up for some high-stakes poker?
I'll play.
How much you got?
Man, that is one hot lady. If she was my woman, I'd never let her leave the bed.
Hey, you like magic tricks?
Can you make yourself disappear?
Lovely day, Mr. Wildhorn.
It's shaping up to be a considerably lovely day. Spot, that lady has a way of making me sit taller in the saddle.
You seem different. You're not yourself.
Right now, I'm seeing things with a clear eye, and quite frankly, I like the view.
What do you want out of life, Mr. Wildhorn?
I'd settle for more nights like this.
There just might be something special about this place.
We dance in the moonlight, held hands in the park. We stroll by the river.
Buenos dias, señorita. I don't know about you, but this music makes me feel like dancing.
I've never had.
Most times, real life doesn't measure up to what's in our heads, but every now and then, it comes pretty close.
Bet.
I respect consistency.
It's a miracle moment of love.
Let me tell you, I saw this film last week, and I thought it was so lovely and delicate and enchanting. And as I was watching it, I kept thinking, this must have been the most pleasurable experience to make this movie.
It really was. It was like a summer of love. I mean, I feel like we all went away to film camp. And we stayed, and like this was our summer project. We got to all, you know, live in little cottages around the lake. You know, we had breakfast together, and then the camp counselor came out and said, okay, here's your assignment for today. We're doing these scenes, and you guys are going to be on the art department, and you're going to be on the camera. I mean, it was like, it was incredible. It was such, it was a lot of hugging and a lot of singing. Morgan singing all day long, and all of us singing with him. You know, he's a big Sinatra fan, and so am I. So that was just incredible, and a lot of food, and you know, they have White Castle there.
Uh-oh, yeah.
Oh, man. So I, yeah, it's like, and so I have this thing that I, if I, if if I'm in the Midwest or I'm somewhere that where they have the White Castle,
mm-hmm.
I will have what I call White Castle Wednesdays, and I will bring hundreds of White Castle burgers to the set. Now, I'm not necessarily bragging on myself, because I confess that the reason I do this is so that I won't be the only one with onion breath. And then I can eat it, and no one will go, are you going to fit into that costume later?
Well, that sounds like a beautiful time. That makes me wish that I was on your sets on Wednesday, actually.
So, yeah, people have a good time on my sets, that's for sure.
This is such a, I mean, this is such a funny and warm movie, but it also has a very kind of meaningful message to impart. And what about that message spoke to you in particular?
Well, you know, I suppose that I can't really tell you what the message is. That's something that an audience has to tell me what they came away with. You know, I could say that after I read it, you know, it brings to mind sayings like, it's never too late. You know, love arrives when you least expect it.
Mm-hmm.
Never give up. Things like that. That's what spoke to me in the story.
Well, that's kind of, I mean, in a way, your character and Mr. Freeman's character, you guys go through a similar evolution, don't you?
We do indeed. I think that, you know, he's sort of given up on life, and I've given up on love.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of us, you know, we have a door closed in front of our hearts. And somehow meeting him, it opens just a little bit at a time until it's open wide. And I loved that there's this little moment in the movie, and this is so Rob Reiner, that where he's sitting looking very grumpy waiting for the bus, and I'm gardening, and we just look at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a take where I kind of smiled and waved, and Rob was like, could you just look at him? Like, you're not sure, just look at him. And same with Morgan. Like, he's like, just look at each other. And it was so simple. And I don't know why, but I really liked that moment.
It's like a recognition.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm kind of like, what's going on? I don't really know what's happening. And then, of course, everything changes when he comes to dinner.
Right.
And when he says, when I'm saying, oh, it's a made-up story, and he says, no, it happened to Jubal.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize how it's a very powerful moment between the two of us, and everything's different after that, because he reveals his truth, then I play the piano and reveal something of mine.
Right.
And it becomes a way in. So it's really, I really love the way their story developed.
I do too. It's a really beautiful dynamic, but there's also the relationship between you and the girls that play your three daughters in the film. And I'm always curious when about depictions of family units in the movies. Do you have an opportunity to kind of establish a bond with them, or does that just kind of evolve naturally in the process of making the movie to make that feel natural?
Yes, you know, I think you have to. You have to allow it to develop naturally, but there's also specific things that you need to do when you're working with children. And when I read this, I was like, whoa, we have three. Mm. And that's a lot of dialogue, and there's a lot of work that the children have to do. So I specifically asked them to pick a room in the house that would really be the mini O'Neill house that I would set up. And I said, I've brought all the supplies. I've got beads. I've got paints. I've got pipe cleaners. I've got glue. I've got, you know, give me an art room. And because I did a lot of that when my boy was small.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that, I said, because sometimes they won't be able to go out and play. Sometimes we'll have to keep them focused. We'll have to keep them together. And they'll also learn to trust me. And we'll all get to know each other that way. And Madeline Carroll was wonderful because even though she's a teenager, she has a very sweet nature. She was never impatient with them. They all sort of became sisters. They all really liked each other, the girls. Mm. And so Maddie helped shepherd the girls and, you know, helped tie their shoes and would sit at the table and bead with them. And their mothers, their real-life mothers, allowed me to mother their children, which I am eternally grateful for. They allowed me, like, they didn't hover, mm-hmm. and they didn't try and even join in. Sometimes they did, because I was like, come on, come into the art room. But most of the time, they got to have a little break. And then I really sort of became like, I called myself their movie mom. You know,
right.
I became their second mom. And then that room in the house, you actually see in the movie. It was a sun porch that they were just going to put, you know, some wicker chairs in. And it became the art room. And they brought me easels, and there was, you know, art taped all over the walls in there, and there was glitter all over the floor, and, you know, I was like, I realized quickly that you cannot use glitter on a set. Very, very bad idea. It travels all over. it was a real bonding experience.
Well, the thing about children, too, and, you know, I equate this with our greatest actors, and certainly Mr. Freeman is in that classification as well, is that just by their very nature, they're completely open.
Yes.
Do you find that? That's a valuable acting partner to be across from, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, there are, you know, there are actors that are more affected or actors that are more spoiled, or I find that the male actors are more so than the female actors. Maybe because it's harder for us. I don't know. But mm-hmm. But I don't like the separation that's created by someone who's spoiled.
Right.
I don't like the uncomfortable nature of a set when there's a bad apple. And so when you really get to the people that are the best, they are the most open. You know, Morgan Freeman is probably the greatest living actor that we have, and he's the most open. When work is done, he doesn't take it home. I mean, someone was asking him about that, and he said, I'm just not that kind of actor.
Mm-hmm.
I've always left my work on the set, and so do I. And I think that Rob well understands that although he's extremely focused and he knows exactly what shots that he wants to get, and, you know, we chose an excellent DP, a woman named Reed Morano, who was just fantastic with the Alexa camera. But yet I think he knows that if there's a relaxed family feeling on the set, that everyone can be more creative.
Right.
The more bonded people can come, in my experience, the more bonded people are, the more creative they are. And then you have a better film.
Well, that's before I let you go, this is the last question I want to ask you, and it is about directors and how they kind of facilitate an environment in which you can do your best work. Does that have to do with that kind of freedom and sense of security? Is that what you're looking for from a director?
You know, I like to work in an ensemble way. You know, I like a director who's going to take me by the hand and work with me.
Mm-hmm.
And because I should not be left up to my own devices. You know, some of my earlier work is clear evidence of that.
No.
Oh, indeed, yes. And so I just think that, like, Alexander Payne is like that. Mm-hmm. You know, he really has this also really beautiful atmosphere on the set so that everybody just wants to follow him. Mm. Everybody wants to do their best. And he'll let people know what a good job they're doing. Rob does that. You know, nice work, I like that costume. Nice work, Virginia, I like that take. You know, he'll take the time to be supportive of his family, which is his crew. Mm-hmm. So other people may work differently, but this is the way I prefer to work. And I do my best work in that atmosphere when it's a family affair.
Yeah. Well, Ms. Madsen, it is a beautiful movie, and you're beautiful in it, and I so appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you so much. I appreciate yours.
Okay, Virginia Madsen, the movie is The Magic of Belle Isle, available now, video on demand services, and in select theaters July 6th. Okay, guys, guess what turns 30 years old tomorrow?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so 30 years old would be 82, right?
Yeah.
I want to see The Thing or Blade Runner.
Yes,
it's
Blade Runner. That's Blade Runner. It's Blade Runner.
It is? Okay.
Yeah, released June 25th, 1982.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Just want to let everyone know that.
It's funny.
Do you get prizes?
Recently, I picked up a whole stack. Somebody gave me a whole stack of Starlog magazines.
Mm-hmm.
They used to be the only entertainment source out there for that sort of thing. So.
And they all come from 1982. Like, and they're in perfect condition, you know. So it's really funny, like, going back and taking a look at them and seeing The Thing coming out and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Poltergeist and... It's really fascinating going back and reading some of these magazines, too, and, like I was just looking at an article about some French film festival that was going on, and the last paragraph said that the winner of the short film, the Dark Comedy Award, was Charlie Kaufman for a movie that he made called Mother's Day back in 81. So... It's like it's fascinating looking there and seeing names of people that got much bigger later on, you know. But yeah, it's weird that all these movies are aging, you know.
Yeah.
It does seem like yesterday. But
what do you guys think of that movie, The Entity? It was 1983. Barbara Hershey.
I haven't seen it in so long. I couldn't give you an informed opinion about
it. I haven't either. But
isn't it
like cult status now, that movie?
Yeah.
Definitely.
For sure.
I mean, it's funny. There's a review of The Entity in one of the. I also got some Cine Fantastiques, which was another great magazine that's now gone. But and there was a review of that movie in there. That movie's great, like up until the final third, and then they seem to, you know, that it's got this outlandish final third where they rebuild the house in this you know controlled environment. Because, you know, it's about Barbara Hershey plays this woman that's getting repeatedly raped by this ghost, you know, that comes in. And it doesn't matter where she goes, the ghost follows her and everything. So the doctor, played by Ron Silver, who's investigating this paranormal experience, says, well, let's rebuild your house and see if he attacks you in here, you know, so we can film it.
That sounds like a sensible solution.
and it's just, it's insane, you know. It gets so far away from, like, the sort of character study that it starts out being.
Well, I sent out a batch of, like, interview requests the other night, and The Entity is coming out on Blu-ray. It's making its debut. It's been hard to find for a long time, I'm sure. But so I invited Hershey and the director of it, Sidney J. Fury. Remember Sidney J. Fury? Remember that name?
Yeah. That's it.
Okay, and what was the title of the movie he directed starring Chuck Norris and Louis Gossett Jr.?
Oh, that would be Firewalker.
Very good.
That's a Gary question.
That's your trivia. Yeah, absolutely. They're coming out with a lot of Chuck Norris Blu-rays, too. It's like Code of Silence, Lone Wolf, McQuaid, all the Missing in Action movies.
Uh-huh. Like,
they're really scraping out the library there for Blu-ray.
Yet Sorcerer, you still can't find Sorcerer. That's too bad.
Now, I was watching, because I got the 39 Steps the other day, and so I was watching some stuff on that, and it made me kind of go into a mini investigation of Hitchcock last night, and I was watching old interview clips and stuff, and he was talking about his work with actors and how he, how method actors are very problematic for him on film. And I think the example that he loved to use more than anything, anyone, was Charles Laughton in a movie they did together called Jamaica Inn. And his point about method acting was that it worked for the stage, but not so well for the film, the way he shot movies, because he has a series of shots that set up an emotional kind of thought process. The thought process of an actor is expressed through the sequence of shots that he chooses. So if the actor then says, I don't think this character would look this way, all of a sudden Hitchcock, that throws that whole visual scheme out the window. And it was just, it was too much trouble for Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
So is that...
You definitely understand that.
Yeah, so is that smart? I mean, that doesn't necessarily fit into his actors or cattle mentality.
Well, it was smart for the way he made movies, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, his thing was not about, you know, the actors. The actors were just there, were necessary in order to tell the story, but it wasn't, you weren't paying your money necessarily to see the actors. You were paying your money to see the story unfold. And,
right.
And the story was the main concern, and he told his story shot by shot, and all those shots were mapped out, and I guess he just didn't have any time for people saying they didn't have the right underwear on for this scene or whatever, you know, because this person wouldn't wear this underwear or whatever. So it's like, you know, I mean, you got to understand, he's coming from a different time where, where acting was quite different, you know, back then, you know.
But I've also seen, go ahead, Jerry.
I would say that I can't imagine Hitchcock really giving in to any of these method acting. It just seems against his grain.
Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah. Well,
I mean, I guess, you know, the closest he might have come, although I haven't seen this movie in a long time, but, you know, his last movie, Family Plot, had Karen Black and Bruce.
That's a really
Bruce
good
Dern.
Movie.
Yeah,
I like that movie
forever. If you've seen it recently, Jerry, did you get the sense that, you know, that he was kind of getting more into the sort of method acting or a different age of acting kind of?
Well, I mean, it's definitely there's definitely that sense. It's been like 12 years since I've seen it, but you definitely get that sense because he's definitely trying to. You know, I think anybody, you know, you get the feeling with it, just the cast alone. It's just not enough there to really work with, you know. And so it would have been interesting to see that, the marriage of his directing style with method acting. That would have been an interesting thing to see, but I don't think it was ever going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of Hitchcock, two things that kind of jump off from that. I saw new behind-the-scenes set photos of the Hitchcock movie with Hopkins and Hitchcock. And God bless it. I mean, I'm really rooting for this production, but it looks ridiculous. I mean, they're behind-the-scenes images.
Yeah, I saw
ridiculous.
The one that you posted. I just didn't know. I really didn't know what to say about
that. What about it?
It looks like he's playing Stan Laurel or something. I mean,
well, it looks like a cross between Nikita Khrushchev and Don Rickles. I mean, you know.
Remember what I said when we talked about the first photo of him and I piped up and I said it doesn't look right. It's like there's too many wrinkles in his forehead or whatever.
No, but
like
the wrinkles are actually there because there are pictures of Hitchcock. Actually, the picture that they modeled that after, and it looks just like him from profile.
Uh-huh.
But these are full frontal facial shots.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it just it looks a little ridiculous, and it's got me worried. But at the same time, I think about, you know, how an actor can transcend and just have you believe him as that character, as Hopkins
right.
has done for me before. So, I mean, I'm remaining very hopeful, but I just thought I'd throw that out there. Also, I mean, another Hitchcockian director that method actors enjoy working with is De Palma.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was somebody that has a very strict visual scheme. But I was thinking about this because I watched this again the other night too, Carlito's Way. And everyone points out that, you know, most of what's great about that movie outside of Hitchcock, outside of De Palma's style, is Sean Penn's performance. I mean,
mm-hmm.
here's quite a method actor, Sean Penn.
Mm-hmm.
And he is astounding in the movie.
Yes, he is.
But I think he gives the wrong performance for that movie. Because I have never been able to believe that the two of them would be close. I mean, I could never believe that Pacino would be friends with someone so, on the exterior, so weaselly.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And untrustworthy. Yeah, I agree.
But the characterization is so great and so memorable, I just think
mm-hmm.
it's in the wrong movie.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a fair assessment of that. That's a movie that I have, you know, tremendous problems with, and I think that's one of those problems.
Oh, I thought I'd get some fight over this. Okay.
No, I would have to go back and watch it again. I would definitely have to go back and watch it. I haven't seen it since I think it came out in theaters, so I really couldn't tell you.
I guess internationally, what's the famous film periodical, De Cinema?
10 years De Cinema.
Yeah, they called it the greatest movie of the 90s, Carlito's Way.
Yeah, that's, you know, you can't always
it's a good
them.
Movie, but I don't know if I'd go that. I mean, what are they smoking and where can I get it?
I mean, they're crazy about that movie. And meanwhile, De Palma's, I mean, De Palma won the award at Venice. Venice hasn't happened yet, right?
No, not till it's later, right? It's later in the summer or the fall.
So they're thinking that De Palma will premiere his new movie there this year.
Oh, God, is that going to come out this year, too?
I don't think it'll come out in theaters this year, no.
Okay, please, let's just push some of the stuff back till next year, please.
I don't think it's been bought yet by a distributor. But
okay. I was thinking about this earlier today.
Remind me what that movie is. Does it have a title, I guess?
Passion.
Passion.
Okay.
Lots of girl on girl.
Okay.
Rachel McAdams.
Good for him.
And what's the Prometheus chick?
Naomi Rapace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good stuff. I'm looking forward to it. Meanwhile, do you guys know about this Cloud Atlas movie?
Yeah, now let me ask you this. Are the Wachowski brothers directing it? Not Wachowski brother and sister directing it? And
yes.
Or is it James McTeague directing it?
No, three of them are. I mean, her name now is Lana Wachowski. And then her brother Andy Wachowski. And then Tom Tykwer.
Tom. Oh, he's directing. Oh, well, and I mean, this is really Don DeLillo territory. So this is coming out this year. I know that.
They pushed it up. I mean, they believe in it. They pushed it to October 26th.
Okay, everyone that I know who's read this book loves it. I've never read the book. I have it in a pile here. I've never read it. Everyone says it's an awesome book. That doesn't mean anything, though, as far as movies go.
And one of those really tough books to adapt. Apparently.
Yeah, I mean, let's. Why don't we go ahead and do Gravity's Rainbow while we're at it? And
I guess they're different sections of the film that each of them directs, and they kind of
right.
intersect.
Okay.
And they're sect.
No, it's a curiosity, Jamie. It's a real. I would definitely. I mean, but you have this and Cosmopolis coming out in the same year, and
that's crazy.
Well, Cloud Atlas stars Tom Hanks and Halle Berry and Jim Broadbent and Hugo Weaving, as all their movies do, and Sarandon and Hugh Grant. And it's all of them play multiple characters. There's lots of makeup in which they kind of make themselves invisible from character to character in this movie.
Wow, okay.
It's an ambitious
thing. This should be
thing.
Interesting. So this is coming out this year. Oh, great. You know, guys, just release everything this year. What were they all really believe the Mayan calendar was true?
I think they are. And you know what makes me nervous is if the world does end this year, I read that HBO isn't releasing its Phil Spector movie with Pacino until 2013. I was like, what? See, that's first and foremost in my mind. Not my loved ones or anything like that. If the world ends, I won't be able to see the new Pacino movie. What the heck?
Maybe they'll get a preview out before.
I hope so. I know the world's about to end, but we have to get Emmy consideration. Let's get these out there. In your mind, what is the best? What is your favorite Hitchcock?
Oh, you would have to ask that, wouldn't you? Oh my God!
What would you say are his top three?
I can only say my favorites, but
yeah, I could say my favorites. Not his top three, but I could definitely give you my favorites.
Give me your favorites.
Okay, should I go before you, Dean, or do you want to go?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Oh yeah, let me go. The sacrificial lamb. I'm gonna go with. I mean, this is notorious. It's definitely a favorite. Definitely a favorite. The birds, and on Vertigo. I mean, and I watch these at various points in my life, but I'd have to say those are three that really stand out to me, and there are others I like a lot too. I like Family Plot a lot. I mean, I watched that like 12 years ago, but I'd never seen it before, and I thought it was wonderful.
I have the ones that I return to again and again are, number one would be Rear Window. I never get tired of
that. That's another
window.
One.
It's just that whole schematic of, you know, of the story and, you know, the little films inside all of the each different apartment is great, and I just find that fascinating. Huge fan of Shadow of a Doubt.
That's a great one.
Shadow of a Doubt is I just love that. I love the script. I love every actor playing the, you know, those family members. Even the kids in it are funny, you know, that Thornton Wilder script and the score and just the driving nature of the story. And I think it's really perverse having that weird character played by Joseph Cotton invading this sort of our town sort of thing there. And then, Psycho is great, no question about it. That was my intro to Hitchcock, you know. But I would have to go with The Wrong Man as my third favorite because I find, you know, that though I find a certain sense of freshness in The Wrong Man because there's, that sort of quasi-documentary thing going on. It's one of the first, might be his only movie. it's definitely his first movie that shot mostly on location, but it's also the only movie that he did where it's based on a true story and it's, you know, it's shot in the actual places that the story unfolded, you know, the actual courtroom, the actual jail cell, everything. I love Henry Fonda in it. And it just unfolds. It seems to be that kind of movie that kind of exists sort of in a Hitchcock world, but also in that sort of world of, kind of noir, 50s noir, you know. So it has that. It's that fine line of that studio world versus the, you know, the noir world. You know, that was shot like all on locations in L.A. or whatever. So I really like those three. What about you?
I'm a Rear Window Psycho guy, but I really want to look at Vertigo again. Actually, they're releasing 15 Hitchcock movies in a big box set, a collection. in September, I think, many of them on Blu-ray for the first time, and just like hours and hours and hours of extras. And all his biggies are on there.
Lifeboat's another one that's always had a big impact on me.
Yeah.
That's a really good film.
What was the Hitchcock on the train? Strangers on a Train. Yeah.
That's another. I mean, you keep naming these. I mean, there's so many. I mean,
I even like some of his, you know, more obscure stuff, like Under Capricorn there's one of them that's so obscure, I can't, and its name just flew out of my head. But, you know, what's the movie with Montgomery Clift? Where Montgomery Clift plays a priest in it. I can't remember the name of the movie now, but I like that one. He was always fascinating. Yeah, always good.
Brett Easton Ellis has been tweeting.
You followed this link, okay?
Yeah, he's been tweeting about Kubrick. I know he did the other week, and I saw it. I didn't think much of it, but I guess he's trying to argue that Kubrick was a homosexual filmmaker.
And not in a bad way either. Not in a derogatory way. He just means that it would add to his. It would even make him a more fascinating filmmaker.
Okay.
If Ellis is saying that, it's not in a derogatory thing.
Not that he was actually homosexual making films, but...
Yeah, no, I don't see the evidence, and I mean, I don't see that, but if Ellis sees some...
I don't care, obviously. It doesn't matter either way, but I guess Ellis's point is that it's all there in his films. Inside Proof, Ghosts in the Shining giving BJs, and Tom Cruise being attacked as gay and Eyes Wide Shut. If you believe that Stanley Kubrick was gay, if you look at his movies as though he were a closeted homosexual, it's actually fascinating and illuminating. You know, and we go through all these theories ad nauseum as part of the Kubrick series, and this is one theory that I've never heard or explored or thought about. The subtextual personal meaning of A Clockwork Orange actually makes it even more interesting if Stanley Kubrick was in fact a gay man, according to Brett Easton Ellis, and he offers no explanation as to that.
Well, A Clockwork Orange, you know, is a term that came from Anthony Burgess, of course, and that means it was somebody who something that looks organic but is actually inside is mechanical.
Well, yeah, and the actual phrase is as queer as a clockwork orange.
Right. Yeah, it does come from a British slang.
Yeah.
Thing like that.
He says Eyes Wide Shut makes total thematic sense when viewed as the dream movie of a gay but closeted filmmaker, and it stars Tom Cruise, no less. Okay.
I mean, that's a.
But he is. You know, remember Ellis. Now you got to look at the biography. Ellis maybe, you know, has never come out as gay, but he is, you know, there. He may be, so he might be trying to project himself on the Kubrick. I mean,
as do all these theorists when it comes to Kubrick films. I mean, they're projecting their own private, you know, their own viewpoint, as we all
right.
do to that extent when we watch movies. You know, our own experience. He says, "I never said Kubrick wasn't a loving husband or father. Only that his films are filled with allusions to homosexuality, suggesting a closeted gay." And then he says, he asked the question that we asked throughout our interviews. Why is Jack Nicholson reading a Playgirl magazine in the lobby of the Overlook before his interview?
I never noticed that.
We talked about that a lot. You never even listened to our Shining show, dude.
It's true. I haven't listened to it.
Oh.
I never noticed that at all, but is it also like that the voice of Hal is the voice of a homosexual man, you know? Is that the...
But let's also see something else about Ellis, and as much as I respect him, remember, he is trying to get a movie made with Paul Schrader. So he'll, I mean, this is obviously trying to, how shall we say it, any kind of publicity is going to, you know, drive people to that Kickstarter or whatever. There's another site, too. So he's trying to get the candy made. He wants to make his name relevant. So, you know, that you have to keep that in mind, too. As cynical as that may sound, you do have to keep that in mind. Maybe he is trying to piggyback off us. I don't know.
No. I'm just saying he's trying to piggyback off us. But I mean, he doesn't know anything about us, I'm sure. But I'm going to make sure right now that he does. I'm going to send him. I'm going to reply to this tweet about the Playgirl magazine. Here, I'm doing it right now. All of your answers can be found here.
I mean, I guess you got to, you know, the whole thing about the reach around and you know, Full Metal Jacket. And, you know, I mean, he's right. There are a lot of. You know,
I just sent him the link to our Shining show. So hopefully
he will listen to it. Hopefully.
No, but actually, since we did the Shining show, I've read some more stuff on that Playgirl magazine, actually. This is the kind of investigative research I do. The articles in it, let me try to find the link. The articles in it actually have a lot to do with the themes of the Holocaust.
Wait, the articles in that particular issue?
Yes.
Of Playgirl magazine?
Yes.
Okay. This is hilarious. All right.
It might be hilarious, but it, you know, we've talked about all this Holocaust stuff and this and that, and there's an article in there about the American Indian, and it's right there on the cover. I mean, there are definite articles in there that deal with the themes that we've talked about. And so it seems more than just, you know, oh, that's a coincidence. You know, come on, it's not a coincidence.
Well, you know, I'm laughing not just because, you know, people are picking up on that stuff, but I'm laughing at the notion that it could be true, you know, that
And also, also, here's the most important, not the American Indian thing, I'm sorry, incest. There's an article in there, and it's right there on the cover of the magazine, Incest, Why Parents Sleep with Their Children.
Mm.
That's one of the stories in the issue.
Can you see that in the movie? Can you see it? Is it clear?
Is it clear? You'd have to freeze frame it. But he is holding the – he is reading the magazine in the lobby, face up, cover up, and then he gets up. He puts the magazine down on the table. But you have to freeze frame it. And they have freeze frames here in the –
Well, now, I totally believe that Kubrick puts that stuff in there and does put it there on purpose. Let me give you an example of one of those little tiny details that I think he put in on purpose, but it's in another movie. It's in Eyes Wide Shut. There's a scene in Eyes Wide Shut where you remember when Tom Cruise goes back to go and visit the prostitute that he almost sleeps with?
Right.
And then he finds her roommate in there, and he's waiting. He knocks on the door and waits. He has a cake or something for her or whatever. And if you see this movie on the big screen, you can see that behind him on the there's like a bulletin board behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And pinned up there is a notice for sale, original Keith Haring art, you know. Now that's, you know, okay, well, who's Keith Haring, whatever. Well, Keith Haring was an artist that died of AIDS, so it's a little bit of foreshadowing there.
That's the actual scene where she tells Tom Cruise that the girl that he almost slept with was just diagnosed with AIDS.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. So there's lots of little things, you know, strewn throughout all of his movies that I think are, you know, that we think are just throwaways, but they're actually put there, you know. I think that he finds it funny and fascinating. He found it funny and fascinating to put those kind of things in there. I wonder if people would pick up on it.
God.
So I
I'm going to watch that movie again tonight. There's just so much in that movie. I'm just obsessed with that movie.
It is great. And The Shining or
I love both movies. The Shining in particular is just a for this kind of stuff. It's great.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, when you see them on the big screen and everything, you know, there's so many more details, you know, like the, you know, I mean, I've watched sets filled with little things like that, like, you know, him meeting the prostitute in front of a key and lock shop, you know, that's funny. You know, the key and the lock, you know.
Yeah, I get it.
it's funny, you know, all that stuff, you know, little details that are thrown in there just to keep him amused, I think.
All right, let's do our list, and then we'll close off with our final interview tonight. We'll be back Wednesday night with movies that need sequels.
Yay!
And then we'll be back Sunday with our hour-long William Friedkin interview. Did any of you guys see that foreign film Bullhead?
No, not yet. I want to. I have
it
on my Netflix.
Yeah.
It was nominated for Best Foreign Film. Got the director of that, so find a show for him.
Okay.
Here's our list. It's the best I could do. I'm sorry, guys. The 10 least scary movies of all time.
Oh, no, not this list. I haven't seen any of these except for one. I've seen one.
All right,
right,
just go for it, Jamie. Just dig in, Jamie. Just go for it.
You read this list?
Go for
Jean?
It.
Okay.
I've already read it.
Okay, The Happening. No argument there, right?
No. I mean, I was scared that I wasn't going to get my money back, which I didn't, so yeah.
That old scary wind. I mean, there's a scene in, like, Nutty Professor 2 around the dinner table that was scarier about wind.
Yeah.
Thinner.
Okay, oh God, oh my God, okay.
I mean, a lot of these are just bad movies, you know. What scary doesn't really even enter into it, really.
Well,
because,
when you make
you
a
know,
horror
not
movie,
even,
when you make a horror yeah. movie that isn't scary.
Well, I mean, that's being done routinely now. I mean, that's the interesting thing about this list. Routinely now, movies aren't scary at all. They're not even meant to be scary. They're meant to be funny. And I think that's what a lot of these movies are, is they're meant to be funny. You know, especially later on in the list. But yes, Thinner is a terrible, terrible movie. That's the only one that I've seen.
Alone in the Dark, Uwe Boll. Okay.
Now, Alone in the Dark, you know, they tell you who's, you got to remind us of some of what some of these are. Cause,
Uwe Boll, Christian Slater.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. All right.
I mean, the scariest thing about it is what I've just described. Uwe Boll, Christian Slater, Tara Reid.
Yeah. Oh, it's Uwe Boll. Oh, my God.
Pulse,
okay.
A remake of a Japanese horror film written by Wes Craven.
There's a couple of Wes Cravens on this list.
Pulse. Man, that was a real trend for a while, those Japanese horror film remakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that died quickly.
Wes Craven's Cursed.
Never even saw it. I mean,
now which Christina Ricci, right?
And Jesse Eisenberg.
Oh, wait, it was the werewolf movie. Oh yeah. Oh God, no, I did see this. Oh, this is awful. It's not scary. It's not anything. It's just like whatever. It's a movie about werewolves. It's just not much of anything. Yeah.
Yeah. I Know Who Killed Me, Lindsay Lohan.
Right. Yeah.
We actually had one of the co-stars and the director of that movie on. And
I never saw it. Everyone said what a great piece of trash it was. And I just, you know what? You know, I don't want that to be the last movie I watch if I died after it. So.
Silent Night, Deadly Night.
These are all
Night.
Movies that would probably improve with a group of friends and six, a case of beer.
Definitely, at least a case of beer.
Screw the friends. They're just going to
yeah.
beer.
You've
got
to have somebody to make wisecracks to, you know. You can't just
need... Yeah, you definitely need that. You do need that.
Drinking the beer by yourself and making the wisecracks into thin air, you know.
I do that all the time, man.
That's just sad now. That's just sad. Okay.
Silent Night, Deadly Night, 1984.
We got a lot of sequels out of it, though.
That was the earliest film that they had on the list.
I actually watched this last year, Silent Night, Deadly Night, and I watched the really funny. I watched the Jack Frost.
Oh my god! Okay, go next.
I love that movie. Wait a minute.
Let's get back to Jack Frost for a second here. Is that the thing with Michael Keaton? Is that what you were talking about?
No. The horror movie.
Oh, we're talking about the horror movie. Okay.
Yes.
Isn't Jack Frost also the name of the movie where Michael Keaton dies and comes back as a
snowman? Yes, yes.
Oh my God, that movie! I tried to watch that movie because I got to see this to see if it's actually real or whatever. Because I just can't believe that someone, boy, that is real up there.
But the horror movie Jack Frost is great. Leprechaun is their number 8. You know what? I prefer Leprechaun to the Hood. I laugh a lot in Leprechaun.
Yeah, I think everyone prefers Leprechaun to the Hood.
Well, that's kind of like what made that kind of got more popular after Leprechaun in the Hood. Like, everybody went back and looked at Leprechaun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bride of Chucky.
Right. I mean, all those.
Well, these aren't scary. These are just, like, these are really all camp.
These are
comedies.
Yeah.
These are comedies, like, you know, straight comedies. Yeah.
Speaking
I mean,
of
who made
cheese,
this list? Is it someone who didn't understand something make this list?
The Hollywood Reporter.
This was somebody who was on a deadline, and the editor said, "Get me a list and get it fast." And he said, "Okay, I'll just think of 10 shitty movies." Buying.
Okay,
you know,
let's go. I'm curious where this is going, so let's keep going.
They're making another Chucky movie they just announced.
What?
Yeah, I forget what it's called. Something of Chucky, of course. Seed of Chucky or something. It could be Seed of Chucky.
Well, no, they've already done Seed of Chucky.
Yeah,
right?
So what is it, like Bar Mitzvah
of
Chucky?
Of course they have. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay, and next are all the sequels to Jaws.
Really?
That's their end thing, right? All the sequels to Jaws.
Yeah. Two is decent. I mean, anything stacked up against the original is majorly
lacking. It's going to fail, but...
But in relation
but
to part
is
three
decent,
and four,
I agree with
two is decent.
Brody's in it, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. Okay.
Three is just so funny.
It's amazing, like, the drop-off in director quality that they had with that series. Because, you know, two is directed by a guy named, and I'm going to massacre his name, but I think it's Jano Schwartz.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
and I can't even remember who did three or four. It's like they just gave up trying. It was like,
well, I think
by
the fourth movie, they had actually taken in a guy on the side of the road with that will work for food. And they were like, do you want to direct Jaws 4? I mean, that's some work for you. I mean, just take it worse than Jaws 4. But Jaws 3 is actually, I mean, there's such a delightful awfulness about Jaws 3 that's just great.
I agree that seeing it in, it's
3D.
Fun trash. Yeah, I did too. And that scene, don't they blow up the shark in that one too? And the jaws, like, are still floating and they come up and do the 3D thing?
Yeah. I mean, that's really the only way to get rid of the shark is to blow the hell up, I guess.
Yeah. Did they get rid of the shark in any other way in any of the movies? Because I can't remember what they did in 4, but... They blow him up in every movie, right?
Yeah, I can't remember anything about 4. Nothing.
Yeah.
Except the shark follows them to the Bahamas or something.
Yeah, he's very smart. The shark is very smart.
All right, so we'll be back Wednesday night to reveal movies that need sequels.
Okay.
We close out tonight with an interview with Barbara Friedman Doyle. She has a new book out called Make Your Movie, What You Need to Know About the Business and Politics of Filmmaking, and she comes at it from the inside. She was a freelance production coordinator and production supervisor for all the major studios and cable networks. So she knows what it takes to get your foot in the door and keep it there. We'll be back Wednesday night and then next Sunday with Freakin. Thank you so much, guys.
All right.
Thank
no problem. It was great. A lot of fun. Have a great night.
Good night, everybody.
See you later. Good night.
I'd like to give our listeners a sense of where your passion for film began and how you chose to pursue that passion.
I was always a huge film buff. I am also an extremely compulsive reader. And I just love storytelling in any form. And so whether it's books or film or television, a good story, well told, completely hooks me. And I started off there. I started off thinking I want to be part of the storytelling. And movies was, to me, a combination of, and it, you know, writing a book is a very solitary activity. When you make a movie, you're part of a huge team. And when you make decisions about the movie before it's even made, you get a lot of creative input, and you get to shape that story.
And so and that's the path that you wanted to be a part of, that creative process that led to. But how did you have any idea how to go about accomplishing that?
No, I had no idea whatsoever. Actually, I was all trial and error. That's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, was so people didn't have to do what I did, which was kind of spend several years trying to figure it all out. I moved out to LA. I worked in the rock and roll business a little bit. And then I definitely, you know, used that as sort of a way to get into the movie business, because production is production in some ways. Mm-hmm. And my background was in PR. And I thought, well, I can write, I can organize events, I can do certain things. How can I take that skill and use it to get a job in the film business? And so it was definitely something where I was going to work in production, because those all are part of production. And I came out to LA. I knew nobody whatsoever in the film business. And I thought, well, you know, I have college and I can type. So I went to a temp agency that specialized in sending people to work at the studios. And I said, you know, I will take anything as long as it's in production. And they sent me out on a couple of things that were pretty dreadful. And then they sent me out as on a job interview to be the assistant of the head of production at the studio. And the reason they sent me, even though I didn't have any experience really, I had, you know, little experience working on commercials in New York City, they sent me because of my education, strangely enough. They said, this guy, you know, wants someone smart. And
well, you know,
they sent me, and it was just this huge opportunity, you know, somebody who's just has not very much experience except being a PA in, you know, on the streets of New York, getting to work for the head of physical production at a major studio, and I was there for 5 years.
Wow. You know, and it's a big part of your book. You talk about the kind of the stepping stones, like you've just described, but an essential part of that is the cultivation of relationships. I mean, would you say that that's one of the major points to success in the industry, is to cultivate those relationships?
Absolutely. And I will tell you that in one way or another, the relationships, the people I met and the relationships I made during those 5 years at the studio were responsible for the next 20 years of freelance work I did. I mean, the next 20 years, only one job on a film, and I did a lot of films and a lot of television movies, only one came sort of out of, you know, almost like randomly. The rest were completely because I had met someone in that first job who recommended me to someone or who was making a film or who knew me somehow towards that, and I was that totally reliable, obsessively perfectionist person in the office that they remembered. And when they needed someone to sort of take care of their production, they thought, you know, we'll ask her, we'll hire her.
Yeah, and I guess that's where it comes in, because they always say it's who you know. But obviously, mm-hmm. talent and hard work, you have to have those. But then it is who you know, and it's about making an impression. Not only with your talent and hard work, but with your demeanor, demeanor of professionalism and loyalty, and that's important. Yeah,
it's very important. I mean, there are two things. People do not want to be embarrassed by people they work with. Number one, because the industry is an industry of appearances, and how people act is very important.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know that when you are in the film business, you are always so busy. And it's because of the way the business is structured, where until something gets going, there are often only two or three people working on it. And then all of a sudden, when you make the movie, yes, you hire the 55 people. And then when you finish making the movie, it's down to those two or three people again. So it's a very busy business, and they want someone they can rely on. They want someone who sort of sees what needs to be done and does it quietly and without drama.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't have to think about it anymore, because
right.
that's sort of one thing they can cross off on their list of worries. They don't want to have to worry about you.
Mm-hmm.
If you get hired in a job, whether it's an entry-level job, a mid-level job, even a very high-level job, the one thing people want to know is that you are going to be completely responsible for doing that job in the best, most careful, most thorough way possible, and then they don't have to think about it anymore.
Right. So when you see people on this path that you took initially, where do you see them fail most often?
I see this sounds very stuffy, and believe me, I'm not a stuffy person, but I see people not looking at it as a profession and looking at it as sort of just a fun thing.
Mm.
And it's really, it is a lot of fun, but everybody has to realize that this is a big business. This is, you know, you work on a film, that's a multi-million-dollar business. And so, yes, it's fun, but if you treat it like a game, if you treat it like it's, not seriously enough, if you are casual, even in the way you answer the phone, if you're in that level of position,
mm-hmm.
people don't like it. You know, they want you to always be sort of up and smiling, and it's almost like the appearance of being casual, but treating it extremely formally and as if it is the business that it is. And I see
right.
that as kind of a big mistake, is people being a little too loose. And even in a production office, people kind of, you know, where the dress is informal and a lot of the discussion is informal, and yet you still have to know there's a pecking order, there's a hierarchy. There are times when someone asks you what you think, that you don't just blurt out whatever you think. You always have to be mindful that you're in a business situation.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great advice. And also, I mean, it's in terms of the casual manner that you just brought up, I mean, I think a lot of people that succeed, especially in the entertainment industry, they succeed because they have to do this. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
it's
yeah,
in their
driven.
DNA.
Yep.
Yeah.
They're very driven, and you have to be driven to want to deal with the stuff you have to deal with. I mean, on the one hand, you're working very, very, when you start out, working very, very long hours. You are not getting paid a lot of money. And something has to keep you on track, and it has to be, it has to come from you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a freelance business, so unlike in a lot of businesses where you work for the same person years and years and there's sort of a guarantee of advancement, in the film business, not only is there no guarantee that you'll ever advance, but you may be doing just great, and then somebody's nephew may need a job over the summer, and they may get the thing that you thought you were training for,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's very much about people and relationships, and you're kind of expected to deal with that. And it can be very tough, and I see people who get very disappointed, and a lot of times when they get, especially, you know, people who are just starting out, they get very disappointed because they mistake the fact that it's a casual atmosphere for the fact that it's sort of one big family. And they kind of have to keep reminding themselves, this is work.
Mm-hmm.
This is work. It's a business. It's not a big family. You know, your family is your family. Your friends are your friends. And your work is your work. And although you can make friends at work and maybe even meet someone and have a family at work, primarily you have to kind of always look at it as this is work, and the driving energy of the work is not you. It's not even the person you're working for. It's the end game of getting the project made.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you write the book in for beginning filmmakers, and you try to guide them to navigate the pitfalls that they might bump into along the way. And I want to talk to you a little bit about those different stages of production that you discuss in the book, starting with the story phase, the scripting phase. Now, there's a lot of books out there about the actual art and how-tos of screenwriting, but when you tackled that phase, what did you specifically want to discuss?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are a lot of very good books about screenwriting out there, and, you know, and I'm not a screenwriter, but I've worked with a lot of screenwriters,
mm-hmm.
and really this, my book is about how to work with everybody, and, you know, there is a sort of a misconception that, you know, if you can think of a story, you can write it, and so people tend to discount the feelings of screenwriters a lot. And they kind of tell them, well, okay, now write this. And that's not the way to work with a screenwriter, just the same way you wouldn't do it with someone who's writing a novel or even a newspaper article. And so there are sort of ways to get your ideas across if you're working in partnership with a screenwriter without telling them how to write. The key to doing well in the film business a lot of times is recognizing that everyone has their part and valuing everyone's part and making them know that you value their part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you do that, the results, first of all, the screenwriter wants to do the extra rewrite. They want to work with you. They want to hear what you have to say. When you don't do that, it's kind of like, what do they know?
Right. Well, there's also the turmoil of, you know, a writer so passionate about his idea, and you hear this every now and then that they sell their script or they make a deal for development of their script, and there are a million little compromises along the way until finally the finished script might not even resemble what they started with.
Sure, the writing is one phase of production. And things change, and they change depending upon the cast. They change depending upon the marketplace, and the writer's job is to understand that. They're not going to ever like it, but they have to understand it. And
mm-hmm.
then the producer and director's job is to make the writer feel good about the part they had in it and try and always look to the story, you know, always sort of, all those compromises that are made, and they're made constantly, does this make it a better story, or does it move it forward to production? Maybe, you know, if you change this, you'll get funding. If you don't change it, you won't. Is it better to not change it and not be able to make the movie? Is it better to change it? How can you change it so that you're true to the story or to the intention of the story? And how can you make everybody feel good about it so that you've got the best possible version of that story, and yet it's ready for the marketplace? It can be hard, right? You know, I mean, writers, it's their baby, and they slave over a script, and, you know, they want it to be as it is, but they also have to realize that in the end, it's sort of, there's a point where they have to be ready to give it away, and then it becomes the director's baby, and then the
mm-hmm.
director has to get it to a certain stage, and then it becomes the director and editor's baby, and then ultimately in the marketplace, it becomes the audience's.
Yeah, and another aspect of this that fascinates me, creative people tend to be not necessarily the most social animals sometimes. And I think of those kind of competing sides of your brain between the creative side and the very aggressive salesman side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you find that those are kind of two different personalities that a lot of creative people have to juggle?
I find that both creative people, if they're lucky, find someone else to take on the aggressive sales aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You know, a writer has to be able to pitch their story, and that, you know, and they have to be able to deal with, you know, producers and agents and everyone. But at a certain point, they are first and foremost a writer. You know, a producer is first and foremost someone who gathers sort of disparate elements, puts them together, and it's almost like baking a cake. In the end, you know, they're a baker. They come up with the cake. And there are people on the business side of the industry who are purely sort of that sales and marketing and agent and negotiation skills. And everyone else just has to be understanding of how the business works and their part in it and how all those things work, most of the time they can avoid actually having to do them, mm-hmm. you know, or having it detract from their main talent, which might be, you know, directing or writing or producing or as a cinematographer or something like that. But the idea is you have to understand it. Otherwise, you will become sort of a victim of the business where you don't understand what's happening to your movie, what's happening to your art, why are you getting phone calls to work or why aren't you, you know, why did this thing that everybody loved 6 months ago become something that nobody wants to return your calls about?
I wanted to jump to something involving post-production and the marketing of your film. That's something that you need to be mindful of from the beginning of the process, isn't it?
Yes, because, I mean, and especially these days, unless there is a way to market your film and get an audience for your film, no one is going to give you money to make your film. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, that was part of it, but you could make a film, get it in festivals, people could look at it, you know, it was kind of the dream of the independent filmmaker. Now, even independent filmmakers have to be very cognizant of the fact that someone is going to be looking at it saying, is there an audience for this? And how big an audience? And that often is going to determine the budget of the film. If there's a small niche kind of audience, that's going to determine how much money they can raise. And people are getting very wise to this, so it's not like you can just sort of, not that you would want to, but it's not that you can just sort of pull the wool on, you know, and say, yes, there's a big demand for this tiny niche subject. You kind of have to go and find the money, you know, in that niche.
Mm-hmm.
And if something transcends that, then it's great. But in general, you know, people are getting pretty wise to whether there is an audience for a film. And you may love a project, just love it, think it's the greatest thing. If you are an executive or a financier and you don't see that you're going to make the money back on that movie, you're not going to green light it. You're not going to say it's okay to move forward.
So you have to be mindful of those aspects of it when you approach potential investors.
Oh, yeah.
What else should you keep in mind when you, as you outline in your book, what else should you keep in mind when you approach people to ask for money, essentially for your project?
Yeah, really, that's what it is. Cast, you know, it's great to have an unknown cast if you're trying to make a little tiny, tiny film, but if you're trying to get distributed, you know, nationally and internationally, you need cast that who is recognizable. It's also very important to know what that means. I mean, someone, maybe a big television star here in the U.S. and outside the U.S., their name may mean nothing. And so that would impact negatively your international distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who you would least expect might have an international following, and you're kind of like, no, really? You know, they're not a big deal here. But some, you know, there are actors who have big international followings. So I would say marketability is one, and along with that, part and parcel of that is your cast. Another thing, and this is a strange thing, but you need to be able to tell the story of your movie in shorthand. You need to be able to have a pitch where people immediately understand what the movie is about. Because a lot mm-hmm. of times, the way a film is sold and raise money is through the poster. You know, a poster and a log line can raise financing, you know, and marketers will tell you that the minute they read a script, one of the first things that kind of pushes them towards saying to the studio or saying to their, you know, whoever, the production company, yes, you should go ahead with this, is can they see a poster in their mind?
Mm. You know, that makes a lot of sense, though, because especially for a first-timer or someone in the independent realm that's trying to drum up some cash, probably from some avenues that have nothing to do with entertainment necessarily, mm-hmm. the investor has to be able to visualize the movie, and they don't necessarily come from the same mindset as a creative person necessarily.
You know, a poster, and I mean, if you give someone who's not used to reading scripts a script, it's very flat. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's very hard for people to look at a script and say, okay, that's going to make a great film, if they're not used to sort of doing that leap in their mind. So you have to help them. You have to be able to tell them the story in a way that they can relate to. You have to have a compelling character who they are interested in hearing, okay, what's going to happen to this guy? Anything where you can hook somebody on and sort of bring them on to the trip of the movie. So whether it's a poster, whether it's a great pitch, it really should be all of these things. Whether it's a cast member where you're saying visualize so-and-so in this role.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be a gettable person, not like, you know, visualize Brad Pitt or somebody like, you know, where, you know, visualize the biggest movie star in the world. I mean, that's hard because invariably your investors will be disappointed. But, you know, but some way to draw them in, because if you can get someone to see your movie in their mind, you can get them to give you money to make the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I guess what you're expressing is you need to express to them the dream of your movie that you have in your mind, but remain realistic. And I guess it's just try to spark in them the passion for the some percentage of the passion for the project that you yourself have.
Absolutely. And while you're doing this, you have to be passionate, because remember, you're saying to someone, not just invest in this story, but invest in my ability to tell this story. I mean, you know, so it's almost like invest in me, invest in the story, invest in my ability to get this all done. And that's a big leap for people, because generally you're not going to someone you know to ask them to give you money. You're going to strangers, and maybe you've got sort of a, you know, some kind of a finder, you know, someone who's found a bunch of people who might be interested. But then you have to, you know, bridge that gap between, you know, they can come to the table. You have to get them to want to sort of jump across the table and give you money.
Yeah. There are so many film festivals out there, and you cover this in your book, and there's obviously the few that we all know are the tops. I mean, and they tend to be to inspire kind of buyer frenzy. How do, if the filmmaker is fortunate enough to be accepted into one of these festivals, how do you navigate that and make the most of that opportunity?
Well, if it's an industry festival, if it's a Sundance, if it's a Toronto, if it's South by Southwest, where people from the industry go, then you're going to do different things than if it's just a nice local film festival. If it's an industry festival, you have to get, the minute you hear your film has been accepted, you have to get to work on getting people from the industry to see that film. Because you go to a festival, there's hundreds of films and lots of choices. Why is someone going to see your film? You have to find a way to get them there. And that may be through some kind of, you know, that may be the point where you might want to have a publicist on, someone who knows these people who can make the calls. Because, again, it's all relationships. You know, someone saying, you know, I'm representing so-and-so who has a great movie. The buzz on the movie is great. You know, please come see it. It's going to be showing at this time. And then afterwards, come talk to the filmmakers. You know, that kind of, you need someone to do that. And so that may be the time where you possibly hire or find some kind of a publicist, some kind of a marketing person or a sales agent. you need to know who are potential buyers for your film, because one of the reasons, you know, a lot of people don't realize you put a film in a film festival almost always in order to get distribution. So who are the people who go to festivals, who just go for fun? Who are the people who go to actually buy? And you need to sort of have a strategy. You know, maybe you want to sell off foreign distribution for little, for very little, so you can say, okay, I have at least some distribution. You know, so that's almost like the thing of somebody wants this film, so maybe you'll want it domestically. You know, you have to have an online or a digital press packet that has all the information about your film, and you have to present that information in the most high-end professional way possible. Who is involved in your movie? Is there anything unique about your film other than the story? What in the log line and in the photographs that are available digitally will make someone want to come and actually choose your film to come see at the festival? Have you gotten any good reviews? Those should be in that digital press packet. You should make it, you know, don't look at a film festival as an opportunity to see films or to socialize. Look at it as a business opportunity. You are there. You almost have a captive audience. You have people who normally you might not have access to. So look at it. You know, this is not the time to have, you know, kind of have the party. This is the time to actually work, and you can have the party when you go home.
You know, and publicists can be incredibly essential in that process, and I just find it from my end when a festival like a Sundance comes up, and I work closely with publicists to get the word out about various movies at these festivals. But where, if at all, should an agent or an attorney come into play?
Well, it depends what you're trying to do. I mean, of course, you need an attorney when you make the movie. You may need an attorney, you know, just for the legal issues of making a movie. You may need an attorney to help you raise money for the film if this is an independent film. But once you're in a festival, you should not be if someone is interested, you should never be negotiating your own deal. You are a filmmaker. They are an attorney. It's worth the money. You know, I can't stress it enough. I've seen more people get sort of a little carried away by someone really wanting their film and signing things and regretting it hugely afterwards, because you need to think about, you know, if you get this much upfront money but no P&A, no prints and advertising money, is your movie just going to disappear?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. You know, you need someone, and it could be an experienced attorney in this area, it could be an agent, you need someone to be able to say, well, this is how this company handles your kind of film. This is how they've done it in the past, and give you an idea of, do you want to go with that company? Do you want to jump at the first offer? Do you want to wait? What is the potential? You need people to tell you this. One of the things independent filmmakers kind of do, they're so used to raising money on their own. They're so used to getting things done on their own that when it comes to the distribution and marketing side, they decide they can do it on their own, and that's a big mistake. You know, at a certain point, you have to step back and say, okay, I'm the filmmaker. Here are the people who really know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to trust them to take care of me.